tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. Iraqi government forces and militias heading for the city of Ramadi today, aiming for the Islamic State fighters who took the provincial capital earlier this week. The future of the country's massive western Anbar province, which borders Syria, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia, is in question after advances by the militant group since mid-May. The U.S. military says the international coalition it leads conducted 22 strikes in Iraq overnight, focusing on Ramadi, the IS stronghold of Mosul, and the area near the oil refinery of Bajai. Five coalition strikes also struck Syria, where a bomb destroyed anti-artillery aircraft systems in Palmyra, known as Tadmur, where IS systems and forces gained ground earlier this week. The Republican-led U.S. Senate handed President Obama a major victory Friday night when it passed the Trade Promotion Authority bill, also known as the Fast Track Trade Bill. Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chairman Bob Corker, a Republican, gave an impassioned plea for the Senate to pass the bill, which he says will help with passage of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Corker says that will help the U.S. export more goods and assist the people of the Pan-Asia region as well.
Importantly, it will draw those countries more closely to the United States, and it will act as a buffer against the dominance that is taking place now with China.
The Trade Authority bill is expected to face a tough debate in the House of Representatives, where it will likely need support of most Republicans to pass. The U.S. Senate has blocked a House of Representatives bill that would have ended bulk collection of domestic telephone data by the National Security Agency. The legislation is known as the USA Freedom Act. The massive data collection program came under fire after it was revealed in 2013 by NSA contractor Edward Snowden. This is VOA News. Visiting one of Washington's largest synagogues on Friday, President Obama reaffirmed U.S. commitment that Iran must not under any circumstances be allowed to gain a nuclear weapon.
Moreover, even if we do get a good deal, there remains the broader issue of Iran's support for terrorism and regional destabilization, and ugly threats against Israel. And that's why our strategic partnership with Israel will remain no matter what happens in the days and years ahead.
Negotiators from Iran and a group that includes Britain, China, France, Russia, the U.S., and Germany have been working against a June 30th deadline for a final nuclear deal to scale back Iran's nuclear program in exchange for sanctions relief. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been critical of the framework agreement with Iran, calling it weak. U.S. and Cuban officials met in Washington on Friday. State Department spokeswoman Roberta Jacobson said she remains optimistic about the talks that she's spearheading between the U.S. and Cuba as they try to reestablish diplomatic relations after a break of more than 50 years.
We have made significant progress in the last 5 months and are much closer to reestablishing relations and reopening embassies. These are the first steps in the long process of normalization that will allow us to better represent U.S. interests and increase engagement with the Cuban people.
This week's talks were the first high-level engagement between the two countries since President Obama and Cuban President Raul Castro met during the April Summit of the Americas in Panama. Still on the agenda in Washington is President Obama's intention to remove Cuba from the list of state sponsors of terrorism. Ireland and voters there have voted to legalize same-sex marriage in the world's first national referendum held in the traditionally Catholic country. Final results are expected later today, but all indications are the yes vote won overwhelmingly and comes 2 decades after the country decriminalized homosexuality. The yes outcome is due in part to thousands of young Irish voters who returned home from abroad to cast their ballots. Ira's Equality Minister, Aidan O'Riordan, says he's proud to be Irish today.
To send this message to the world and to LGBT young people in Ireland and across the world, that Ireland is the first country in the world to introduce marriage equality by popular vote is a massive statement. And we haven't just done it by small numbers. It's an overwhelming vote.
In Europe, gay marriage is legal in more than a dozen countries. It's also legalized in Argentina, Brazil, Canada, New Zealand, South Africa, Uruguay, and many states in the United States. Also today, the oldest known living person in the world celebrates a milestone at her home in north central state of Michigan. Geraldine Tully turns 116 years old. Her family plans to take her out to dinner near her home in a Detroit suburb. Tully, who was born May 23rd, 1899. Tributes her longevity to faith. I'm Marty Johnson in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
We did not get any documents from the outgoing administration on which to work. And they have not been given access to the ministers.
Nigerian President-elect Muhammadu Buhari wants cooperation from Goodluck Jonathan's government. We'll have a reaction.
I think the United States, like many other former friends of Rwanda, they see troubling developments.
U.S. Congressional Subcommittee on Africa calls for an inquiry into allegations of Rwandan government involvement in plots to assassinate exiled dissidents.
Well, the Barnabas Association, being one of the fighters for democracy in Ghana, definitely finds it unacceptable for such a thing to happen.
And the Ghanaian Bar Association, or GBA, sharply condemns the murder of a leading member of the opposition New Patriotic Party, NPP. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Nigerian President-elect General Muhammadu Buhari has expressed concern that his incoming administration is misunderstood by opponents. This shortly after receiving an interim report about the country's state of affairs presented to him by his 90-member transitional committee. Mr. Buhari, who is scheduled to be officially installed on May 29, says his government wants to know the state of affairs before deciding its actions after taking over from President Goodluck Jonathan. Buhari's spokesman Shehu Garba told me earlier that the lack of cooperation is unfortunate.
The committee set up by the incoming president had worked for the period assigned to them, and they reported back to say to him that they did not get any documents from the outgoing administration on which to work. And they have not been given access to the ministers, outgoing ministers, or heads of government departments. So there has been no support whatsoever that has come to them from the government side. Of course, they received a lot of support from the private sector. So in effect, what they said to him is that they received a lot of cooperation from one side, you know, of the society, which is the private sector, and on the basis of which they were able to formulate solutions to quite a number of the problems that confront the country, and on the basis of which government can go into business from May 1. But yes, true that the government had just closed everything and did not allow access to this committee.
The outgoing administration that said that it appeared that the APC and the team, the transitional team of President-elect Buhari, were trying to stampede the Jonathan administration out of power. What is your take on these concerns they expressed?
Please, nobody should take them seriously on that one. Look, it has happened before. Even though transitions in the country have taken place within given political parties, what the president-elect said he expected was that all of these handover documents will be placed on the table in good time so that the transition committee will read and examine them where they need clarification on given submissions. Ministers who are around will be in a position to throw light on areas that need that kind of clarification. As it is now, what is the Jonathan administration? They said they will give handover documents 24 hours before handover. Now, how can you read all of those volumes within 24 hours? And maybe they probably have bought their air ticket, and they'll be flying out of the country. The moment they hand over the next day, they would have flown out of the country. Who do you get to offer clarification on matters that you don't understand? This is what people should understand.
How are plans so far about the inauguration ahead of the official swearing-in on May 29?
Well, they are ongoing. for all we can see, this event started today with the Muslim prayers in the mosque nationwide. So, yes, we have a week of activities. And, yes, this one has started without any hitch. We are hoping that these matters are in the control of the government. They are in charge of outgoing government. That is. We wish that this goes well. We hope that it goes well for the country.
Has the transitional team that General Buhari put in place, President-elect General Buhari put in place, asked for more cooperation from the outgoing administration, especially since, you know, there are concerns that 24 hours before official handover of document might not necessarily be enough for this transitional process to run smoothly when the new administration led by President-elect Buhari takes over officially?
Of course, yes. I mean, this is in the domain of the public. They simply are adamant. Look, I think that they think they have so many skeletons in their cupboard, and they want to shut down the closet. They probably think that it is better than when they will have left. We should open the cupboard and see what skeletons are there. Whatever it is, we'll get there, and we'll get to know this thing. Our transition committee will only take a short break. They'll be resuming at the moment these things are made available, and they will continue with their work.
Shehu Garba is the spokesman for the Nigerian President-elect Muhammadu Buhari. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. This week, a U.S. Congressional Subcommittee on Africa called for a full investigation into the alleged Rwandan government involvement in plot to assassinate exiled dissident. David Himbara was one of the witnesses that testified before the Subcommittee on Africa. He is a former top economic aide to Rwandan President Paul Kagame and coordinator for the North American branch of Rwandan in Democracy Now. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached Himbara after his testimony to find out how the hearing was made possible, given Rwanda's close relation with the U.S.
I think the United States, like many other former friends of Rwanda, they see troubling developments. Instead of opening up space for discussion in Rwanda, open dialogue, a bit of political competition, they see total closure. And then worse, they see what happens to opposition leaders or media people, either in prison or they flee, and of course in some cases they get killed.
Now, in your testimony to the committee, you said that the assassinations of exiled dissidents should be seen as state-sponsored terrorism and Rwanda should be regarded as a pariah state. Those are serious accusations.
Yes, these are serious accusations indeed, but we can quote the president of Rwanda himself. On two recent occasions, in reaction to Colonel Patrick Karegeya, the former chief intelligence who was in exile in South Africa, he said that, it's a pity that the government didn't do it, but people like him, it's not if, but when and how they'll face the same fate, in his own words. Then later, more recent than that, he said, those people who are making noise about human rights abuses, not only are we going to put people in prison, arrest, we will shoot them in broad daylight. So who else can I quote to convince you that this is indeed reality if that is none other than the president of Rwanda?
How big a threat or is it to people like you who are in the diaspora?
Well, I fled Rwanda to South Africa, then I've had to flee South Africa, and I'm in Canada. But even here, the government keeps an eye on the situation. So that is me, but I'm in a much better position because I can, I grew up here in Canada, so I'm a citizen of Canada. But not many people are in my situation. The most people end up in neighboring countries. And honestly, to be a refugee in Uganda, for example, or even in Kenya for that matter, people have been killed in those countries. People have been kidnapped in those countries. So, yeah, it's people are just sitting target.
The witness who testified to the subcommittee at the request of the Rwanda government while disputing your testimony, didn't object to an investigation. Why do you think that is so? Is the government not concerned about an investigation if there was one?
Well, first of all, you know, the person who is speaking for Rwanda, at one point in the hearing, he said that no, he was not representing Rwanda. He was representing himself, that he's an American, Rwandan-American, a journalist and a blogger. But then the committee chairman reminded him something that we were not aware of before the hearing. He said, but wait a minute, it's the Rwandan embassy that insisted that you participate in this, that we invite you. So I'm not sure if that person is speaking for the government or he's speaking for himself. It's too bad that they didn't ask the ambassador. The Rwandan ambassador was right there. But I don't think that man speaks for the Rwandan government. No, I don't think so.
I see. And lastly, Mr. Imbara, what do you see coming out of this investigation if there was to be one?
Well, the hearing itself was really like spectacular in terms of indicating the seriousness of the situation. And you see the Congress was probing also the government of the United States, the two representatives there. They said, what are you doing in Rwanda? What are you following? They had to admit, actually, that there are two stories in Rwanda. There is one of success, but there is also this one of killings, and that they have to keep persuading the government. So that in itself is quite an achievement. But beyond the hearing, as you said yourself, the chairman is going to insist that there is some kind of investigation. If it's not international, he says that the chairman indicated that he would push for a congressional resolution. Congressional resolution, of course, is a powerful tool to persuade the government of the United States to do something about it.
David Himbara is a former top economic aide to Rwandan President Paul Kagame and coordinator for the North American branch of Democracy. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from Toronto, Canada. The Ghana Bar Association, or GBA, has condemned the murder of a leading member of the opposition New Patriotic Party, NPP, saying it is a blight on the country's democratic credentials. The GBA called for a thorough investigation, saying the masterminds should be quickly prosecuted to serve as a deterrent. Adams Mahama, the Upper East Regional Chairman of the NPP, was doused with acid by unknown assailants. He was admitted to a hospital where he died on Thursday. Tony Forsen, the spokesman for the GBA, told me that the organization plans to meet with all political parties in a bid to encourage their partisans to refrain from violence.
Well, the Ghana Bar Association, being one of the fighters for democracy in Ghana, definitely finds it unacceptable for such a thing to happen. Definitely, even though the police have not come out with their findings yet, it is obvious that there were some differences between the late Mr. Adams Mahama and some of the party members. And it is reasonable to infer that this untimely death has some links with those disagreements. And we find it unacceptable that if it is a result of a disagreement, that death should be the result. I mean, we find it very, very, very disagreeable.
Well, Mr. Forsen, I heard the GBA has also demanded an expedited investigation into this killing. How has been the response of the security official so far concerning this call for a thorough investigation into this murder?
Well, so far, it looks encouraging because a lot of people have spoken to this issue. You know, in this part of the world, investigations can take time, prosecutions can take time. But because it has a direct bearing on our democratic experiment, we feel that this must send a signal to people with like minds. You know, if it is investigated quickly and punished quickly, people with like minds will desist from such actions. From the standpoint of the security agencies, I hear two persons have been apprehended so far, and we are also told it has not been confirmed yet that the deceased himself did mention some persons' names. So I think for this one, I think the police are on top of the issues for now. So I think the Lord await whatever findings that the police will come out with.
Mr. Forsen, how are Ghanaians specifically reacting to this?
Oh, well, across the board, notwithstanding the fact that some some of the political actors will definitely take swipes at the NPP. But I believe that across the board, there has been widespread condemnation from both persons within the NPP and the NDC about the state of affairs. This is very un-Ghanaian. You know that they say the Ghanaian is very forgiving. So for such a cruel attack on somebody, it doesn't seem to find favor with anybody. I mean, of course, eventually the political actors will take advantage to take swipes at each other. But across the board, there's been some sobering effect on all persons. So far, I've monitored a lot of the radio programs. Yes, the youth seem to be very animated, but all the party leaders so far seem to be telling the persons in the youth to remain calm for the investigations and the law to take its course. So across the board, I can say on authority that no one seems happy.
What is the Ghana Bar Association's message to the people of Ghana, especially those in the political arena who are having disagreements here or there?
We make a call on the leaders and the supporters of all the political parties that in everything that they do in trying to rule Ghana, we are sending the message that this is rather a contest of ideas, not a contest of brute strength and force. That you sell your messages to the people, and whoever's messages find favor or whoever's track record finds favor with the people, that person rules. And we believe that that is what democracy and the rule of law is about. So it is our call on the leaders, and we believe that in the coming days, just like we did in the case in court when all kinds of accusations were flying around, you know, we met both parties and we told them to exercise restraint. So in this case as well, we'll call on the leaders and we'll try to make definite efforts to meet the leaders so that they could send the message to their people so that peace could reign, because Ghana has been touted as one of the beacons of democracy in Africa, and this is rather unfortunate. So it's our call on the leaders to get their supporters to act as tolerantly as possible.
Tony Forsen is the spokesman for the Ghana Bar Association. He spoke with me from the capital, Accra. On Friday, Zimbabwe marked 2 years since a new constitution came into force. Many thought was more liberal than the previous one. But as Sebastian Nhofu reports from the capital, Harare, for VOA, rights organizations say the reality on the ground has not changed much.
In 2013, about 95% of Zimbabweans approved a new constitution, which officials said would end years of complaints about human rights abuses under President Robert Mugabe's government. Marking 2 years since the new constitution came into force, Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights, or ZLHR, released a statement calling for, quote, a deep and sincere reflection, unquote, on whether the charter was being used to bring better accountability to safeguard people's rights and freedoms. Kumbirai Mafunda, the spokesman for ZLHR, explains why his organization calls the new constitution a, quote, paper tiger that is becoming increasingly meaningless and ineffectual.
We remain concerned by the everyday contraventions or violations of the new governance charter. We are worried that despite the constitution having some protective mechanism measures, the authorities in Zimbabwe continue to act with impunity. Several examples are abound of how the authorities have disregarded the constitution, the issue to do with violation of freedom of expression, the issue with law enforcement agencies continuing to clamp down on protesters. We are worried that the rights as ensured in the constitution, like the right to health, the right to education, is not yet being respected.
President Mugabe's government has said it is bankrupt and cannot afford a campaign to ensure that all clinics, hospitals, schools, and colleges are fully functional. As a result, the right to health care and the right to education have remained a dream. Earlier this week, Amnesty International said it is worried that access to information and freedom of expression are also in danger. Since 2001, when the monopoly of the state broadcaster Zimbabwe Broadcasting Holdings legally ended, only two companies, one owned by a government minister and another one owned by a state-owned media company, have received licenses to operate radio stations. There are no privately owned TV or radio stations in the country. Earlier this week, Jonathan Moyo, Information Minister, told Parliament that Harare was attending to the issue of privately owned television stations.
The Broadcasting Authority of Zimbabwe is proposing that we attend to these matters as soon as possible. The issue, after the appropriate consultations, should be gazetted in the near future, meaning very, very soon.
Another issue is that commissions to discuss peace and reconciliation, new land reforms, and economic disparities between men and women have yet to be formed 2 years after they should have been established. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
The World Health Organization's Regional Director for Africa, Motshidiso Moeti, is urging countries in West Africa to prepare now for the likelihood of a future outbreak of the deadly Ebola virus in the region. She says the current epidemic should serve as a wake-up call to spur them into action. For the UE, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Dr. Motshidiso Moeti is by nature an optimistic person. She is pleased to see the progress being made in bringing the Ebola epidemic in West Africa to an end, though she notes it may be several months before the virus is completely gone from the region. As WHO's regional director for Africa, she knows she has to think ahead and be prepared for future crises. She tells VOA it is very likely that West Africa will have to contend with another outbreak of Ebola in the future.
Because the Ebola virus is in the environment, she said another outbreak could happen. And we are hoping to take the initiative of the concern, the global concern raised by this epidemic and the interest of partners to provide support and financing for preparedness to help not only these three countries but other countries in the region.
Dr. Moeti took over as the first woman regional director for Africa on February 1st. She replaced Luis Gomez Sambo, who is widely criticized for his lackluster tackling of the Ebola epidemic in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. Dr. Moeti cites a number of priorities for improving health in Africa. These include working toward universal health coverage and getting health systems in better shape.
Another area of emphasis will be addressing the social determinants of health and putting some emphasis on prevention, because we think for our region as well, this will be smart investment on the part of ministries, although we recognize it's not an easy area, it'll be an area of learning for them as well as for us.
Dr. Moeti says it will take continued vigilance and increased surveillance on the part of Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea to bring Ebola cases down to zero. Africa's regional chief says WHO will remain alert and ramp up measures in all three countries so the virus is not imported across borders. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, despite a failed coup attempt, Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza remains steadfast in his plans to run for a third term. Demonstrators say he has had his chance. Regional leaders want the June 26 election postponed until the nation is stable. Join us on Wednesday at 18:30 UTC for an in-depth discussion on Burundi. That's right here on VOA Africa.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. Then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy what we have for you today.
Why you make me rock the door? Rock the door.
Open and door, So you open and close well like a door. Can I get your handle? So the car with the second friend.
Let's go! mukisi emeya wakene mukisi aluya imana nwanke na baka misie
shera uma de make you
dekiri wo dekiri wo
na uma de make you
dekiri wo
dekiri wo shera uma de make you
dekiri wo
dekiri wo shera uma de make you dekiri wo
dekiri wo
shera uma de make you
dekiri wo
dekiri wo
dekiri wo
na uma de make you
dekiri wo
dekiri wo shera uma de make you
dekiri wo
dekiri wo shera uma de make you
dekiri wo
dekiri wo
dekiri wo
Money go.
Music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. It's now time for commentary and analysis by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. It's always a pleasure for me to share my reflections on the United States policy towards Africa. Simultaneously, I pay close attention to African opinions on and attitudes towards the United States. Every week, the bloggers, the broadcasters, the journalists, the scholars, diplomats, and all people who are interested in American policy towards the world or towards any part of the world pay attention to their area of attention. I am really interested in what happens in the relationship between the United States and Africa. There are a few points to remember every week. At the moment, the United States is looking at a number of issues globally, but they have relevance in Africa. Today, if you look at the American attempt to promote economic development in Africa while working on policies relating to law and order, the situation in Egypt with regard to the aborted attempt to create democracy in that country from dictatorships under Gamal Nasser and military rule, something that dominated African situations since independence. Because in the early days of African independence, the African leaders who were going through the process of decolonization wanted to address the question of state building and nation building. The Egyptians didn't have any problem of nation building. By the time colonialism ended throughout Africa, the Egyptians were very secure with regard to their identity. And when the United States got involved with Egypt, at this particular period in time, Gamal Abdel Nasser was the leader of a revolution against royalties. That attitude of Nasser and the free officers would reverberate throughout the Arab world. The free officers who took power introduced military and governance in Africa. And this would affect Africa south of the Sahara. That was one of the reasons why when Nasser linked up with Kwame Nkrumah, Sekou Touré, and Modibo Keita, who were the leaders of independent Africa at that time, before decolonization, the United States was very much involved in law and order decolonization. The French were pressurized by Kennedy with regard to Algeria, and De Gaulle finally handed power to the Algerians after a guerrilla warfare, which introduced another question with regard to America and Africa, and that is, how are you going to deal with military rule in an African country or Arab country, in the case of Egypt, where royal families rule in those areas? And the same thing applies in other parts of Africa with regard to royalty. Fortunately for modern Africans, who are very much concerned about nation building and station building, they didn't have a problem of royalty because the royal families were already reduced to insignificant powers by the colonial rulers. The English respected some of the royal families throughout African societies, although they did not give them full recognition. So in Nigeria, you have many Obas, you have people like, they call them Amir in Arabic, they call them Emir, some Nigerians. You see, all those ruling families survived in Nigeria, in Ghana, in Gambia, and all other places, but they were not very powerful. So when you talk about state building, the impact of America on all these other African countries was to push for some kind of democratic republican rule. And this democratic republican rule, which originated from America, has affected not only African countries, but countries around the world. Wherever you had monarchies, they were attempt to somehow move towards the English system, where you have constitutional rule by monarchs. So when you look at America's policy towards Africa, nation building and state building are still important in Africa. The recent events in Burundi underscore the same crisis, because the Hutus and the Tutsis historically were two ethnic groups which share a language, but they are ethnically different. If you want to understand the Tutsis and the Hutu situation, you have to go to Somalia and see what happened in Somalia and see how the different ethnic groups in Somalia united by a language went their separate ways. And this led not to state building, but state disintegration, especially when the Somalis were fighting slavery. And here the Americans came into that equation. During the time of President Bush Senior, when you have the Liberian situation where you have an ethnic problem, state building and nation building in Liberia, and you have Samuel Doe, who carried out a military rule in that country, you have three major issues affecting American foreign policy since the independence of the African countries: state building and nation building. And they have encountered this problem in all the African countries. The most recent one is South Sudan. In South Sudan, state building and nation building. State building was there under the older Sudan, where the state was strong in Khartoum, but it was weak in terms of social solidarity and support in South Sudan. And the Americans are still involved in South Sudan, although the situation is slightly different from the old game, when there were American groups pushing for the South Sudanese. And of course, this is where you come to three important issues with regard to America. That is state building, nation building. Then you have ethnic conflicts and political violence. Americans have been involved in political violence in the Congo. And the Congolese situation is still there. It is not an ethnic conflict as such. It is a problem of state building and nation building. Most Congolese will tell you that they don't have a problem of being Congolese, but their problem is state building. And this is where America comes in. The legacy of Nasser and the free officers who took power in Egypt at the expense of a king, they had no state building problem, but they have a problem of consolidation of the state on the royalty. The royalty was overthrown. And this is how American policy towards Egypt, Ghana, and the rest of Africa would be echoed in Libya, where Muammar Gaddafi, following Nasser, created a coup against the royal family. And that was the end of royal families all over North Africa, except Morocco. And that's the way it is today.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nyang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America and from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, John Dryden. We say a big thank you for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, does a man not know when he has pepper in his eyes? If we forget yesterday, how shall we remember tomorrow? I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States considers the promotion of an open and secure internet to be a critical component of its foreign policy. America believes, said U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry in a speech at University of Korea, that the internet should be open and accessible to everyone. We believe it should be interoperable so it can connect seamlessly across international borders. We believe people are entitled to the same rights of free expression online as they possess offline. But many governments will use any excuse to silence their critics and impose filters that eliminate broad categories of what their citizens can receive and transmit. What's more, these governments are quick to export their repressive technologies and methods to others, thereby further undermining individual rights. Many of these governments are also using the internet to track down activists and journalists who write something that they don't like. There's a clear separation in the world between governments that want the internet to serve their citizens and those who seek to restrict access to the internet in order to control their citizens. Governments should not fear free speech. Banning the internet in a misguided attempt to impose order, said Secretary Kerry, will never succeed in quashing the universal desire for freedom. Just as we promote freedom online, the United States is working to prevent international conflict in cyberspace. The basic rules of international law apply in cyberspace, said Secretary Kerry. Acts of aggression are not permissible. The U.S. is supporting a set of principles that will contribute to a more stable cyberspace. If the principles are implemented by countries, we would be living in a far safer and far more confident cyber world, said Secretary Kerry. Throughout the global community, said Secretary Kerry, we need to come together around principles that will establish a solid foundation for our freedoms. Principles that will protect the rights of individuals, the privacy of our citizenry, and the security of our nations, all at the same time.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.